Hello, I'm Laura.
And I'm Cam.
And welcome to the Giving Voice podcast from Chandler House at UCL, where each month we invite special guests to help us explore an area of speech and language therapy you've always wanted to know a little bit more about.
Plus, each episode we will share our peaks and troughs of being a student speech and language therapist, and we get to stick our noses into the lives of our fellow students at UCL.
Hi, Kat.
Hi, Laura.
We're not on Skype.
I know. I mean, the sound quality might be similar, but we are actually face to face right now.
In the flesh.
Yes.
It's really fun. It's getting to see you.
Yes, we're having a socially distanced park meetup right now.
Yeah, it's part of the rules now, guys. It's
fine. Yeah, I like the way we've chronicled our lockdown experience throughout
this podcast.
Yeah,
actually, it's true. It's nice to have like a virtual diary of the whole thing.
So what have you been up to? Because you're not living in London at the moment.
No, I'm not living in London. I'm up in London seeing my boyfriend. We've bubbled together, so that's been nice. But I'm living currently in Epsom, and which is where I'm from originally. And I'm working in a COVID rehabilitation hospital not too far away from where I live, which has been really interesting. And I've been doing mainly physio.
We're also having a very British meetup in the park because it is not sunny.
It's not nice.
it's very windy and like rain is threatening. So
yeah, it could literally be down at any minute. It doesn't feel great.
Anyway, carry on. I think it's died down slightly.
Yeah, I'll just keep talking, see how it goes. So I've been doing mainly physiotherapy with people that have been in comas for a really long time, really poorly with COVID, and just getting them up and walking again is the main aim, I guess. So that's been really interesting. But just generally working in like a hospital that's just been set up, and with lots of different health professionals around, has been really great. Obviously under not great circumstances, but it's been really interesting, and I've actually got to do like a little bit of voice therapy and a little bit of stage therapy.
I was going to ask if you were getting to do any speech and language therapy.
Yeah, a little bit. It's obviously, it's not a priority if we're being honest, but I've managed to like snuck in a couple of bits, and a speech therapist has been on the ward and I've shadowed her when she's been about, which has been
Oh, that's really great.
Yeah, it's been nice. It's been good. She comes in on Wednesdays. So if I'm on shift on a Wednesday, then I get to spend some time with her, which is good.
Amazing. And so how long is the like normal stay for someone when they come into the rehab hospital?
So we aim for 2 weeks, but I would say it's slightly longer than that at the moment on average, depending on the patient. We have got some patients that haven't actually had COVID, and we're just doing some general rehab with them. But I'd say like 2 to 3 weeks is probably the average length of stay. So quite a long time, and you get to know them really well in that time. And actually we've had a couple of issues with people not wanting to leave, because that leap from being in an institution where you're having therapy all the time to going home, and the problems that you're having being more evident because you're kind of living a more normal life, it's quite a big leap for people.
Do you have psychologists on the ward?
We have mental health professionals come occasionally, because a lot of people have PTSD for obvious reasons. But it's mainly medical, to be honest.
Right.
How about you, Laura? How are you doing?
I'm good.
Good.
Yes. Feeling pretty pleased to have coursework assignments in, Viva done.
Oh, thank God, yeah.
which was a bit of an experience, because obviously we had to do our Vivas over Teams, Microsoft Teams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How was yours? Did you find it okay?
Oh, it was okay.
Yeah. It happened.
That kind of, you try and do loads and loads of revision, and then, it's over so quickly.
Yeah, it happens so quickly, isn't it?
Yeah. But it was fine. You know, a lot of just motor mouthing. A lot of that.
When you've got 4 minutes, you got to squeeze in as much information as you can. Go.
Indeed. Yeah. Just really happy for that to all be done.
Yeah, good.
Anyway, so this week we've got an interview with Christella Anthony.
Yes, very excitingly. Yeah. She came to give us a lecture back when lectures were happening. I can't remember when.
Another lifetime ago.
Yeah, back when that was happening. about transgender voice, which is a really, really interesting lecture and one that I won't forget in a hurry.
Yeah, no, she's such an interesting person and such a personality. So yeah, let's hear a little bit more from Christelle.
Let's do it.
Hi Christelle, and welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Laura. Nice to speak to you.
So first of all, could you tell me a little bit more about your work as a speech and language therapist?
Well, I'm a consultant speech and language therapist and I work in voice, so I'm a voice specialist. It's another way I refer to myself. I qualified in 1995 from UCL and I had the opportunity to work in a variety of settings, you know, community, wards, clinics. And from about 1997, I began really specialising in voice and seeing mainly outpatients who were voice patients. And that was mainly in the NHS. But because I started off in the NHS in a kind of a part-time role, because I really wanted the job in this particular place, working with a particular manager, and it was a part-time job. But actually, I was still involved in a family business then, and it gave me a perfect opportunity to develop, after a couple of years, some private work alongside, not because of any huge ambition for that, actually, but because I just kept getting requests from ENTs to, you know, do I see anyone? And if you're in a hospital like Charing Cross, which I did end up in after the North Mid, there's a big ENT department there, so there's usually potential for lots of work. And so it's been a combination of private and NHS for a long, long time, but now predominantly private, because I have my own clinic and run a business. So that's you know, you need kind of quite good attention on that. But I've kept a little small job at Charing Cross, allied to a joint voice clinic and a few specialist outpatients. So that's what I do. And it was predominantly adults, but as I've gone more and more private, there's been more requests for working with children's voice disorders, and that's been a part of my work. But because I was at Charing Cross, I had a perfect opportunity really to enter working with transgender voice. And for a long time now, say since 2001, when I got that job there, the gender identity clinic, you know, I've had a big proportion of my caseload is transgender work. So it was quite nice to be maybe at the forefront of that. You know, there were certainly clinicians doing it, but it was not such a big job, I suppose, for so long. And then that job grew from one day to 4 days at one point. So that's a lot of people to see and gain experience with and develop training courses and treatment protocols from that.
So when did that all kind of kick off, the work in transgender voice? When did it start getting more and more in demand?
Well, I remember when I started, there was a job, I took the job in 2001, and a lady who'd been working in the field for ages, who I admired a lot, called Judy Challoner. She'd been the main therapist in London seeing people, and she'd moved into doing it just privately. There was always a one-day job at Charing Cross, but when I inherited that job, there was a 10-month waiting list, which gives you an idea of, people had to wait 10 months to get an initial assessment. Gosh. Which I thought, that just has to change. That's not enough provision. That's impossible almost for some therapists to develop. You know, there was meant to be a research component to that job, but clearly no provision made for research. And actually, I'm not shy of saying to people that I went for that job about 2 years earlier and didn't get it, because I asked that question. Well, it's a one-day job with a long waiting list, so what's the research support? And because I asked the question, the feedback I got was, it looked like I wasn't committed to research, which I thought, actually, I asked a practical question and it was realistic. There was never any scope for that realistically in the job. You know, I was just gathering data with my laryngograph recordings and those kind of things, so I could prove efficacy and outcomes that way, but not in a way that there was any chance to do something that meaningful with it. So I would say it really blew up. Even at that point, it was about 3 years later, I'd say, that things started really growing. And about 3 years after that, it became like everybody, you know, there were so many more therapists doing it, and it just kind of grew big time from about 2011-12 onwards.
Is it just specialists that work in that field, or can it be
I would have said to you when I first did it, you needed to be, you know, have some voice skills, you need to be working for a couple of years to do it. But because needs must, and because of the lack of kind of uniformity in the way people do get their specialist training or any kind of training post qualification, you're really dependent on which therapist comes your way that's willing to kind of do the training, or which department you're in, and how much, you know, you're able to gather from your colleagues. I'm all for kind of having a more structured specialist training post-graduation. But for now, that's how it works. And I've definitely trained people from scratch post-qualification. I've done that with somebody at Charing Cross, who then went on to get my job when I left that place. And I've done that with somebody just in my private practice. So it works in the NHS because I'm doing the same level of specialist training and the same care into making sure they understand the processes, have the right background, do enough observation of me, you know, and have enough supervision. And I think a lot of people can't offer that. But if someone's going to work under my kind of, you know, method of voice change, I want them to be secure and have consistency, because consistency and getting secure outcomes for people is what makes people believe that it works, and it not only grows your reputation or the reputation of the department, but you get successful outcomes. You're achieving client goals. And the bottom line in all voice therapy is, are you helping people achieve their goals, you know, that they are capable of achieving? Obviously, some people have limitations, but, you know, the whole goal of therapy is to make a change, and usually a positive change that benefits the life of the client.
And how do you measure those goals? Is it all just on an individualized goal basis, or do you have specific measures that you use?
More or less it's very individualized. However, because most people, I would say the majority, ask for a similar kind of outcome. So if I'm working with trans females, which is kind of the bigger part of the trans caseload for most speech therapists, I ask them, I do a very little quick subjective assessment beforehand, which is, you know, how satisfied are you with your voice currently, you know, how do you think it sounds now? And I use these subjective headings from the TVQ, which is a voice questionnaire that's like been standardized. And then I ask them, ideally, how would they like their voice to sound? And I tick the boxes that the client tells me. I don't tell them how they should sound. I don't say, well, you know, we'll be happy with a gender neutral voice, or be happy with a somewhat female voice. Sometimes, very rarely, people ask me for a gender neutral voice, or sometimes they ask me for, you know, somewhat female, they think that's all they can achieve. But if I say ideally what you would like, I think 85 to 90% will be choosing very female to, you know, female to very female. And so I've always been driven by that goal, really. Clearly, if there are massive limitations why somebody wouldn't do that, you would work with them to, you know, to get what was possible for them. But I've always thought things are more possible than people think.
I've got one more question on this topic, and that's, what are the biggest misconceptions that people have about voice work with this client group?
Well, there are quite a few. I think probably the biggest one is that people feel that there's only limited voice change possible by feminising, and so that they're or masculinising, either way. But particularly for feminising, because there's no help with the hormones, because once you take oestrogen, it doesn't have an effect on changing your voice. Everything is done by yourself and by the person you work with, you know, helping you do that. So they contact me about surgery before they've even thought about therapy, which is really something I'd like to change, because while I've been probably the biggest supporter of voice surgery since I've been doing this, because I was so experienced with it, because a lot were carried out at Charing Cross in the old days, you know, for several years, it was kind of routinely done at Charing Cross Hospital. It was only when, from about 2013-14, it became a non-core procedure, the surgery. So a lot of the therapists now aren't so experienced with it, but it can be a really helpful adjunct and support to voice change. However, 80-90% of the work I do is with people who don't have surgery, and so it's very possible to achieve, you know, the outcomes the clients are searching for with just a good therapy model and some skills in terms of helping people navigate through barriers, because there are lots and lots of doubts and challenges for trans people changing voice. So there's that misconception that only limited change is possible. Of course, for some people that might be the case. And also, I think it's important that SLTs don't impose their view that only a little bit of change is possible. Sometimes I see a fashion for kind of pushing just a gender neutral voice because somehow that's more authentic. But more authentic for who? You know, I never want to put my view onto the client. The client says to me, I want to sound female, very female. I'm going to work to that until my ability says I can't do any more for you. I'm not going to make a judgment that they want to sound very female. I think, well, if you've always felt in the wrong gender and you want to sound very female, that's what I'm going to do. So it's really about listening to the client. And I think there's been a bit of a fashion for moving off that and the PC-ness of telling people what, you know, what's what's you know, it's okay if you sound just a little bit, that's just enough, everyone's really accepting of trans stuff. Actually, no, their day-to-day experience is not that. The gender academics, for example, sometimes say to me, oh, aren't you contributing to a gender binary by making people sound, you know, like very female? And I'm thinking, some people want to be in a gender binary.
Yeah.
And just because, yeah, you know, that you know, that is actually the majority. And while I love gender diversity, and I think it's great if people want to be non-binary is great, and it's a place that I would heavily support and always do. But you know, if that's not what the person wants, to be in a kind of a neutral, non-conforming way, then I'm not going to suggest that to them. You know, I think that would be insulting on some level, you know.
And it's not a client-centered goal at the end of the day, is it?
It's not a client-centered goal, and that's what started to puzzle more recently, this kind of push away from them.
Yeah. And you mentioned the voice surgery that people can elect for sometimes. And is that debulking the vocal folds, or what does that involve?
There's a few techniques. For a long time, the main technique was there's a cricoid cartilage and a thyroid cartilage at the front of the neck, yeah. And they would make an incision at the front of the neck, pull the skin back, and kind of suture the thyroid cartilage and the cricoid cartilage together. So you're closing a gap, closing the cricothyroid gap. And when you do that pulls the vocal cords, so they thin out. So the vocal cords are tensioned, and thinner tensioned cords make a higher pitch. And it was kind of, I would say, successful in some cases, probably in about 50-60% kind of had lasting change, but there was a big percentage that didn't. And I think it was because a lot of them didn't have therapy or adequate therapy or therapy with an experienced enough therapist beforehand, and they didn't have any follow-up therapy, so that made a difference. And more recently, they've been using vocal cord shortening as well. So if the two things that that characterise female vocal cords are that they're thinner and shorter. So that's what the surgery tends to do. And you can do that by putting a suture there or creating a little web so the vocal cords shorten. And there's also some lasering that can be done to thin out the vocal cords. So there's a kind of a combined, a glottoplasty approach and a cricothyroid tensioning approach that a lot of doctors are combining now. And that tends to yield the better results.
But as an adjunct to therapy as well?
I think so. I think the cases of where people just get a result from surgery are still, you know, still quite rare. And I always prefer that people try to work on their voice first, because if they do and they get good enough therapy and they do well, you know, they're motivated enough, they will not require the surgery. You know, and I've had people who have had amazing voices in therapy. I think I've played some at the lecture that I gave, and great outcomes. And then they were still asking me for, could I put them forward for pitch surgery? And I was used to be get so disappointed about that, because I thought, I don't think I could have done anything different or better there. But it shows you how deep the psychological concerns are about people's voices and their perceptions. And you know, obviously I would have worked with that, you know, explored that with them, but sometimes their arguments were very compelling, you know, like it would just help me relax so much more. I really want to start dating, and this is the one thing that I'm still not, and I don't want anything to just give it away. And you know, so I think what I noticed was when they had the surgery was, and because I could trust the people I was referring them to as well, they weren't going to just go and disappear some faraway country and have it done. You know, I knew they would get good care. They did psychologically feel a lot more comfortable. And in both cases that I often play as teaching cases, their voices were lower after surgery, because what had happened was they'd actually relaxed a lot of the techniques. They were lower, but not lower in a way that it took them to a male range. But they were lower in a way that made them feel more comfortable, only by about, say, 5 or 6 hertz. But it was interesting that they didn't maintain a higher pitch afterwards, which you'd think was what they were searching for. But that psychological benefit, security of having a pitch surgery, just made them think, well, I can just go forth now. And, you know, but I'm sure that all the pre-work they've done is what gave them that extra outcome to their voice, because it's not just about pitch, which is primarily what pitch or voice surgery does for trans females. It's more, there's lots of aspects involved, you know, how you use your voice and tone of voice and variation in voice is not something that pitch surgery can necessarily give you. So yeah. I think there's always going to be a bigger role for speech and language therapy than voice surgery.
Thank you for that. I am aware of the time, so I am going to move on to our other topic that we're talking about today, and that is more about promoting speech and language therapy as a profession. So my first one is looking into why our profession is quite undiverse. I mean, it's primarily white, middle-class females often. And I just wanted to get your perspective on, you know, why, what are the public perceptions of speech and language therapy that keeps it biased towards women and undiverse?
I think the public's perception of it is kind of driven by how the profession has been, really. You know, there's no way that's going to change unless, in a way, the profession does a little bit more to promote it in a different way. And, you know, it's full of amazing good clinicians who do amazingly good things and do such a valuable job. I mean, I think you probably gathered from my lecture how proud I am of being a speech therapist in the profession, and how in a way still I love it so much, you know. But what's been disappointing to me, having had all that kind of wish to become a speech therapist, and the way that, you know, my career, which has been a little bit unconventional, I suppose, in the way I've driven it, but you know, has rewarded me in lots of ways. But what's still disappointing is that when I do the lectures, when I go places, when I run the courses, I'm seeing that kind of population that you just described. And so there is definitely a lack of diversity. I think traditionally it did come out of kind of, you know, nice ladies going to kind of a speech college, and you know, it was the way it evolved, you know, like in the way that women have had to fight to evolve their professions. That's been part of it. It's always been harder for women. And you know, and I'm somebody who's massively into gender diversity and supporting all genders and all expressions of gender, but I'm still a feminist, you know, and that's perfectly, those things can perfectly live together. And one of the things is, you know, I'm always admiring of women who've driven their professions forward, you know, made more CEOs in companies and done initiatives to do that. And for us as a profession, I think, because it's still quite a mysterious profession to lots of people, I think that's partly the problem. I don't think most of the public, if you stop them, would give a very good description of what a speech therapist does. And certainly they would not know how expansive and extensive the fields are as speech therapists. And that's like what I said when I was lecturing you recently, was that for me, it was the fact that, oh gosh, I'm a Gemini and I'm interested in lots of things and I'm quite creative and all that. And I thought, this profession has got so much in it. You know, this is, you know, it's going to be communicative, but, you know, it's also got this kind of scientific side, and it's got so many fields. And if I got fed up of this field, I could do this and I could do that. So from, you know, working with aphasia to the deaf, to autism, to voice, to dyspraxia, to all these things. And I don't think most of the public has a clue about that. And I think one of the things that all of us should be trying to do is bring it to people's attention a bit more, be able to showcase outcomes, be able to showcase what we do. And you know, our college does brilliant things, you know, with government and mixing with government and, you know, all that kind of thing. But I think it needs a slightly more popular approach to it, in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even coming home and telling my housemates about my new placements I've had, even, you know, I've was placed on a dementia ward, and my friend was doing head and neck cancer and lots of different things. Somebody was doing voice, and I was telling my my housemates about it, and they were like, well, Why would you need a speech and language therapist there?
It was always there was a big debate about the name, you know, about our name doesn't kind of trip off the tongue as easily as physio, and our acronyms like SLT and SALT don't particularly explain what we do, whereas a physiotherapist is much cleaner, you know. Maybe occupational therapist was always a bit hard as well, but even as me as a voice specialist, you know, one of the things I try and teach people about is that I'm not a voice coach. You know, I'm not a voice teacher or a singing teacher, because I work with lots of singers. I'm a speech and language, a voice specialist, which means I'm an allied medical health professional. And that kind of allied part, you know, the health stuff is and the academic level we have to get to is not known, you know, and we get mixed up sometimes in. And whilst I love collaborating with all those people, it's not the same thing. You know, we are able to do voice rehab because we have links with medical professionals. So we can identify things, we can refer people, we can liaise with a GP, and it's multi-connected, and that makes it both brilliant. But also it's kind of a thing that lots of, I think, the public aren't aware of.
Yeah. And as speech and language therapy students are going to be hopefully listening to this podcast,
yes,
what kind of advice would you give us from the start of our careers to change these perspectives?
So think about the profession as a whole. Kind of appreciate the kind of its value to, you know, to society and what it can do. Showcase what you do, like think about becoming good at the job, because the better we are at the job, the better outcomes we get for people, the better people say, I saw no speech, like my child had a speech language therapist and she was amazing, you know, she did this my job. Or, you know, it was really good, the speech therapist worked for my, you know, worked with my dad after his stroke and now it's so much better. It's stuff like that. It's staying focused on outcomes for clients that's going to drive this profession forward, because that's when people start saying, you know, my friend had a speech, I want that for my child, or I want that, but I know someone who, and I have to say that, you know, if your business is like mine has been bit mostly in reputation, not because of like advertising or seeking to get busy, actually, it's because people say somebody recommended you or this or that. And that's really important. And then if you can show outcomes and say, you know, so and so many people, you know, we did a survey and so many people said that, you know, they value speech and language therapy this much, even if it's that kind of survey. Or with me, it's easy with voice. I can play voices. I'm in the one of the easiest places to say a before treatment and after treatment. I can get a subjective result. I can get an auditory result. I can get an objective measurement. I can measure pitches and irregularity. So for voice, it's really no excuse to not showcase outcomes. I think other professions it's harder, but we can always get subjective feedback, and it's really what matters to the client. That's the most, you know, most important thing. So we've got to demonstrate that more. I think the more people understand what you do, what outcomes are achievable, the more interest there's going to be, not only from the public but from other people wanting to become speech therapists. Like you say, going back to the diversity, why there's a lack of it, people don't really know what it is a lot of the time. And my foray into it was quite unusual in a way, in that I don't think I would have heard of speech language therapy if I hadn't had a speech language therapist as a child for treatment, you know. And I was quite young then, but I was always struck by the therapist, actually, not so much the therapy but by the therapist. And when she said one day she couldn't come, I was disappointed because I liked her so much more than the teacher at the time. I was only very small. I used to skip across the playground and love going to speech therapy, because it was a chance where you got some attention and you could perform. And I remember the second lady was just as kind of nice to work with, and just as, you know, it just was such a safe place for you to get something to help you. And that feeling hooked me in and taught me there was the profession called speech and language therapy, because it stuck with me. And when we went to careers training and all that, they said, what do you want to be? Oh, I want to be a speech therapist. And I wasn't really ideally suited with the amount of science they really kind of wanted you to have, or, you know, scientific-ish stuff. But, you know, and it was a bit of a long way round for me, you know, getting a different degree in humanities and then getting into a master's. But I got there in the end because the feeling or the knowledge of the job hooked me in. So, you know, I think that's the kind of level we need to try and get it into people's consciousness. You know, people who've had therapy, we need to try and gather more testimonials from people. We need to, you know, and bring it to a, you know, bring it to a wider consciousness.
I like that. Yeah, well, that's fantastic. Really, really inspiring to to hear someone who is so passionate about speech and language therapy. Mm. You know, that really struck a chord with everyone in our lecture when you were really, you know, saying, come on, like we really need to promote this profession. And it's true.
It's gonna be a way we secure our futures. I mean, when I heard that the bursary was lost that speech therapy used to get, I don't know if that's come back yet, Laura. I think, is it?
No.
Well, no. I'm hugely, hugely disappointed about that. I mean, it really upset me, because it's just another way that it's not, you know, taken as seriously as it should be. And I'm sure our college campaigned really hard for that. But I think when there's people power behind it, we are a lot stronger. You know, anytime anybody I've worked with, if they've got a bit of a profile, you know, anytime I can get them to say something to kind of help put this on the map, I'm doing that now. I would have been really shy to ask of that now, but now I'm thinking this is the kind of thing that brings it, unfortunately, to people's consciousness. Any kind of, you know, celebrity contact, any kind of thing that just makes people just, oh, I didn't realise, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and also that taking the bursary away will impact diversity even more, I imagine.
It would, and we need to talk about that, and we need to make a fuss about it. You know, we need to somehow, I don't know, campaign, lobby a bit more. Or, you know, I know that now they've brought it back, I think, for nurses, because when that happened to nurses, I thought, well, that's great. Now you're going to lose a load of good nurses. They're going to have to recruit loads of locums and people from abroad, and there'll be a shortage of nurses, you know. And that's exactly what happened, and that's probably likely I mean, there's luckily there are more speech therapy students than there ever was, but now, you know, it might not be that there's many jobs for them. And I always remember being interviewed at UCL and them saying, you do know that the force bill they wanted to make me clear, you know, I was aware what speech therapists got paid, as if to say this is kind of more a vocation than a money job. And secondly, the other one, I said, yes, I was very well aware. And the second thing, they said, you know, it may not be a very well paid job, but you'll always have a job. So now it's a better paid job, but there's no guarantee so much of a job. But, you know, I think it's very good that lots of therapists have set up privately as well, because there's definitely a need for that. And I'm really all for people who work publicly and privately, you know, supporting each other a lot more than generally what I see, because there's a need for both. You know, I've done both for so many years. I've loved my time in the NHS. I've really been proud to work there, but I've been able to achieve things creatively privately that I couldn't do there, because, you know, departments have restrictions and budgets. And so being able to excel in the way that just promotes the field, I think, is what's important, and collaborating and working, you know, working together and just getting the best people doing, you know, the best teaching and the best jobs, really.
Fantastic. Well, I think that's an excellent note to finish on.
Thank you, Laura. Good luck with your studies and your podcast, and yeah, we look forward to listening.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Thank
you. Bye, Laura. Bye.
Thank you, Christella, for coming to chat to Laura. That was really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, we had a great chat. We actually carried on talking for about an hour after that.
It was a long one. That's the thing when you get speech therapists together, isn't it? That we can't resist a natter.
I know.
And end up talking about speech therapy in particular for hours and hours. So I'm not surprised. And it sounds like you guys had a really interesting conversation.
Yeah. Well, it's something we, going into our new careers, which is coming up soon.
Yeah, God, scarily soon.
Yeah, it's something to remember to keep promoting our profession as much as we can. Do you know what? I think that is goodbye
from us.
Oh God,
the last one. Oh, well remembered. I completely forgotten that. goodbye from us. We've got two current year A's who will be year B's next year, taking over from us, I believe.
Yes, yeah.
So the best of luck to them. I'm sure you're doing a fab job.
Yeah, and thank you to everyone who's listened to our podcast.
It's meant a lot. We had a blast making it, despite making quite a lot of it from our own homes rather than uni.
I think it's probably something that has got me through lockdown. So,
yeah. It's been a real help. So thank you for supporting us. Yeah.
And thank you to Stephen as well, who actually first came up with the idea.
Yeah, so. Stephen. Thank you for supporting us and helping us.
Guiding us through.
Yeah, exactly. Helping us to produce this. It's been a lot of fun, and I think if we keep going in this way, then we'll really get speech and language therapy out there on the map for more people. So
indeed.
Let's do it.
So yes, it's goodbye from us.
Goodbye. Thank you.